Chapter 20. My conception of New York City came from rap music. I envisioned it as a place where people shot each other on the street and got away with it. No one walked on the streets. Rather, people drove in their sports cars looking for nightclubs and for violence. I really wasn't looking forward to being somewhere this crazy. I had had enough of that back home. It was dark when the plane landed at John F. Kennedy International Airport. It was 4:30 p.m. I asked Dr. Tamba why it was dark so early in this country. "Because it is winter," he said. "Oh," I nodded, but the early darkness still didn't make sense to me. I knew the word winter from Shakespeare's texts, and I thought I should look up its meaning again. Dr. Tamba took our passports and did all the talking at immigration. We got our bags and headed toward the sliding doors. Maybe we shouldn't just venture into the streets like that, I thought, but Dr. Tamba was already outside. When Bar and I stepped through the sliding doors, we were greeted by an extremely cold wind. I felt my skin tighten. I couldn't feel my face, and it seemed my ears had fallen off. My fingers hurt, and my teeth chattered. The wind penetrated through the summer pants and the t-shirt I was wearing, and it felt as though I wasn't wearing anything. I was shivering as I ran back into the terminal. I had never in my life felt this cold. How can anyone survive in this country? I thought, rubbing my hands together and jumping around to generate some heat. Ba stood outside with Dr. Tamba, his hands wrapped around himself and shaking uncontrollably. For some reason, Dr. Tamba had a jacket, but Ba and I didn't. I waited in the terminal while Dr. Tamba hailed a taxi. Then I ran outside and jumped in, quickly closing the door behind me. There were little white things falling out of the sky, and they seemed to be accumulating on the ground. "What is this white stuff falling from the sky?" I thought to myself. Dr. Tamba told the driver our destination, reading it off a piece of paper he held in his hand. "Is this your first time in the city, and are you guys enjoying the beautiful snowfall?" the taxi driver asked. "Yes, it is their first time in the city," Dr. Tamba replied and busied himself putting away our documents. I had never heard of the word snow before. It is not exactly something that we discuss in Sierra Leone, but I had seen movies about Christmas, and this white fluffy stuff was in those movies. It must be Christmas here every day, I thought. When we entered the city, it seemed as if someone had lit the many tall buildings that shot into the sky. From afar, some of the buildings looked as if they were made of colorful lights. The city glittered, and I was so completely overwhelmed that I couldn't decide where to look. I thought I had seen tall buildings in Freetown, but these were beyond tall. It seemed they were poking the sky. There were so many cars on the street, and they impatiently honked, even when the light was red. And then I saw people walking on the sidewalks. I rubbed my eyes to make sure that I was really seeing people on the streets of New York City. It wasn't as dangerous as I had heard it was. Not so far. The lights were brighter than the ones back home, and I kept looking for the utility poles that the electric wires hung on, but I couldn't see any. We arrived at the Vanderbilt YMCA Hotel on 47th Street and entered the lobby holding our luggage. We followed Dr. Tamba to the front desk and got our room keys. I had a room to myself for the first time in my life. To top that, I had a television which I watched all night long. It was really hot in the room, so I took my clothes off and sweated in front of the television. 2 days later, I learned that the reason the room was so hot was that the radiator was on full blast. I didn't know what it looked like, least of all how to turn the heat down or off. I remember thinking about the strangeness of this country. It is very cold outside and extremely hot inside. On the morning following our arrival, I went downstairs to the cafeteria, where 57 children from 23 countries were waiting to have breakfast and to begin the United Nations' first International Children's Parliament. There were children from Lebanon, Cambodia, Kosovo, Brazil, Norway, Yemen, Mozambique, Palestine, Guatemala, the US, New York, South Africa, Peru, Northern Ireland, India, Papua New Guinea, Malawi, to name a few. While I was looking around for Ba and Dr. Tamba, a white woman pulled me to the side and introduced herself. "My name is Kristin. I am from Norway." She extended her hand. "I am Ishmael from Sierra Leone." I shook her hand, and she opened an envelope of name tags and placed one on my shirt. She smiled and motioned for me to join the breakfast line as she walked away, looking for other children without name tags. I followed behind two boys who were speaking a strange language. They knew what they wanted, but I had no idea what to get or what the names of the foods were that the cooks were making. Throughout my stay, I was baffled by the food. I would simply order the same thing, or put on my plate whatever I had seen others put on theirs. Sometimes I was lucky to like what landed there. That was usually not the case. I asked Dr. Tamba if he knew where we could get some rice and fish stew in palm oil, some cassava leaves or okra soup. He smiled and said, "When you are in Rome, you do as the Romans do." I should have brought my own food from home to hold me until I learn about the food in this country, I thought, as I drank my glass of orange juice. After breakfast, we walked two blocks in the freezing weather down to a building where most of the meetings took place. It was still snowing outside, and I was wearing summer dress pants and a long sleeve shirt. I told myself that I wouldn't want to live in such an unpleasantly cold country, where I would always have to worry about my nose, ears, and face falling off. That first morning in New York City, we learned about each other's lives for hours. Some of the children had risked their lives to attend the conference. Others had walked hundreds of miles to neighboring countries to be able to get on a plane. Within minutes of talking to each other, we knew that the room was filled with young people who had had a very difficult childhood, and some were going to return to these lives at the end of the conference. After the introductions, we sat in a circle so that the different facilitators could tell us about themselves. Most of the facilitators worked for NGOs, but there was a short white woman with long dark hair and bright eyes who said, "I am a storyteller." I was surprised at this and gave her all my attention. She used elaborate gestures and spoke very clearly, enunciating every word. She said her name was Laura Sims. She introduced her co-facilitator, Teresa Blair, who was light-skinned, had African features, and held a drum. Before Laura finished talking, I had already decided that I would take her workshop. She said she would teach us how to tell our stories in a more compelling way. I was curious to find out how this white woman, born in New York City, had become a storyteller. That same morning, Laura kept looking at Ba and me. I didn't know that she had noticed. We were wearing only our light African shirts and pants and sat closer to the radiators, our hands wrapped around our tiny bodies, and every now and then shaking from the cold that seemed to have settled in our bones. In the afternoon before lunch, she approached us. "Do you have winter jackets?" she asked. We shook our heads. A painful concern passed over her face, making her smile look forced. That evening, she returned with winter jackets, hats, and gloves for us. I felt I was wearing a heavy green costume that made my body bigger than it looked. But I was happy, because now I could venture outside to see the city after the daily workshops. Years later, when Laura offered me one of her winter jackets, I refused to accept it because it was a woman's jacket. She joked with me about the fact that when she had first met me, I was so cold that I didn't care that I was wearing a woman's winter jacket. Ba and I became a little close with Laura and Teresa over the course of the conference. Sometimes Laura would talk to us about stories I had heard as a child. I was in awe of the fact that a white woman from across the Atlantic Ocean, who had never been to my country, knew stories so specific to my tribe and upbringing. When she became my mother years later, she and I would always talk about whether it was destined or coincidental that I came from a very storytelling-oriented culture to live with a mother in New York who is a storyteller. I called my uncle in Freetown during my second day. Aminata answered the phone. "Hi, this is Ishmael. Could I please speak to uncle?" I asked. "I will go get him. Call back in 2 minutes." Aminata hung up the phone. When I called back, my uncle picked up the phone. "I am in New York City," I told him. "Well," he said, "I guess I believe you, because I haven't seen you in a few days." He giggled. I opened the hotel window to let him hear the sounds of New York. "That doesn't sound like Freetown," he said, and was silent for a bit, before he continued. "So what is it like?" "It is excruciatingly cold," I said, and he began to laugh. "Ah, maybe it is your initiation to the white people's world. Well, tell me all about it when you return. Stay inside if you have to. As he spoke, I pictured the dusty gravel road by his house. I could smell my aunt's granite soup. Every morning, we would quickly walk through the snow to a conference room down the street. There we would cast our sufferings aside and intelligently discuss solutions to the problems facing children in our various countries. At the end of these long discussions, our faces and eyes glittered with hope and the promise of happiness. It seemed we were transforming our suffering as we talked about ways to solve their causes and let them be known to the world. On the night of the second day, Madoka from Malawi and I walked west along 47th Street without realizing that we were heading straight into the heart of Times Square. We were busy looking at the buildings when we suddenly saw lights all over the place and shows playing on huge screens. We looked at each other in awe of how absolutely amazing and crowded the place was. One of the screens had a woman and a man in their underwear. I guess they were showing it off. Madoka pointed at the screen and laughed. Others had music videos or numbers going across. Everything flashed and changed very quickly. We stood at the corner for a while, mesmerized by the displays. After we were able to tear our eyes away from them, we walked up and down Broadway for hours, staring at the store windows. I didn't feel cold as the number of people, the glittering buildings, and the sounds of cars overwhelmed and intrigued me. I thought I was dreaming. When we returned to the hotel later that night, we told the other children about what we had seen. After that, we all went out to Times Square every evening. Madoka and I had wandered off to a few places in the city before our scheduled sightseeing days. We had been to Rockefeller Plaza, where we saw a huge decorated Christmas tree, statues of angels, and the people ice skating. They kept going around and around, and Madoka and I couldn't understand why they enjoyed this. We had also gone to the World Trade Center with Mr. Wright, a Canadian man we had met at the hotel. One evening, when the 57 of us got on the subway on our way to the South Street Seaport, I asked Madoka, "How come everyone is so quiet?" He looked around the train and replied, "It is not the same as public transportation back home." Shanta, the camera person for the event who later became my aunt when I returned to live in New York, pointed the camera at us. And Madoka and I posed for her. On every trip, I would make mental notes on things I needed to tell my uncle, cousins, and Mohammed. I didn't think they would believe any of it. On the last day of the conference, a child from each country spoke briefly at the UN Economic and Social Council chamber about their country and experiences. They were diplomats and all sorts of influential people. They wore suits and ties and sat upright listening to us. I proudly sat behind the Sierra Leone name plaque, listening and waiting for my turn to speak. I had a speech that had been written for me in Freetown, but I decided to speak from my heart instead. I talked briefly about my experience and my hope that the war would end. It was the only way that the adults would stop recruiting children. I began by saying, "I am from Sierra Leone, and the problem that is affecting us children is the war that forces us to run away from our homes, lose our families, and aimlessly roam the forest. As a result, we get involved in the conflict as soldiers, carriers of loads, and in many other difficult tasks. All this is because of starvation and the loss of our families, and the need to feel safe and be part of something when all else had broken down. I joined the army really because of the loss of my family and starvation. I wanted to avenge the deaths of my family. I also had to get some food to survive, and the only way to do that was to be part of the army. It was not easy being a soldier, but we just had to do it. I have been rehabilitated now, so don't be afraid of me. I am not a soldier anymore. I am a child. We are all brothers and sisters. What I have learned from my experiences is that revenge is not good. I joined the army to avenge the death of my family and to survive, but I've come to learn that if I am going to take revenge, in that process, I will kill another person whose family will want revenge. Then revenge and revenge and revenge will never come to an end." After all our presentations, we sang a chant we had come up with. Then we began to sing other songs. We cried, we laughed, and we danced. It was an exceptionally moving afternoon. We were all sad to leave each other. As we had learned, that we were not returning to peaceful places. Madoka and I put our arms around each other and jumped around to the music. Ba was dancing with another group of boys. Dr. Tamba sat in the audience smiling for the first time since we had arrived in New York City. After the dance, Laura pulled me aside and told me that she was moved by what I had said. That night, we went out to an Indian restaurant, and I was happy that someone in this part of the world serves rice. We ate a lot, chatted, exchanged addresses, and then went to Laura's house in the East Village. I couldn't understand why she called the area a village, because it didn't look like any village I knew. Our chaperones didn't come with us. They went back to the hotel. I didn't know that Laura's house was going to be my future home. There were traditionally woven cloths from all over the world hanging on the walls. Statues of animals sat on large bookshelves that contained storybooks. Clay vases with beautiful and exotic birds on them stood on tables. And there were bamboo instruments and other strange ones. The house was big enough to hold all 57 of us. First, we sat around in Laura's living room and told stories. Then we danced into the night. It was our last night in New York, and it was the perfect place to spend it, because the house was as interesting and filled with amazing stories as our group was. Everyone felt comfortable and saw something from their home. Being in the house felt as though we had left New York City and entered a different world. The next evening, Laura and Shanta accompanied Ba, Dr. Tamba, and me to the airport. At first, we were all quiet in the car, but gradually we all except Dr. Tamba began to sob. At the terminal, the sobbing intensified as we said goodbye, hugging each other. Laura and Shanta gave us their addresses and telephone numbers so that we could keep in touch. We left New York City on November 15, 1996. My 16th birthday was 8 days away, and throughout the flight back home, I still felt as if I was dreaming, a dream that I didn't want to wake up from. I was sad to leave, but I was also pleased to have met people outside of Sierra Leone, because if I was to get killed upon my return, I knew that a memory of my existence was alive somewhere in the world.